Accession number 33202, reel 4.
Terry Light, reel 4.
So you would clamber in this basket balloon, this basket which was suspended under a barrage balloon. And this was, of course, weather permitting, of course. If there was a wind blowing, then the barrage balloon would be all over the place, so therefore you'd go back to ground training. The whole course really revolved around getting through that minimum of 8 jumps within specified weeks, weather permitting. So you would clamber in this basket, 3 of you, the instructor, and then he would give the order, winch the balloon up, and the balloon would go up on the end of a halter, and it would go up to 800 feet, and then it would stop. And it would be nervous, naturally. He would take away the barrier, so there was a hole in the side of a gap in the side of the wicker basket, as I call it. There's a balloon up there. And he would explain, right, I'm going to ask each of you to come forward, stand on the edge, look straight ahead, and when I give the order, you jump. And I can't remember if I was 1, 2, or 3, but so what? And to me, okay, you'd look over the side of the barrage balloon, that's 800 feet below, grassy western under the green, so what? So, you know, that was easy. So that was completed all right. And then as you jumped, your parachute canopy came out, and there would be an instructor on the ground using a microphone telling you, keep your legs together, pull on that side and drift that side. So they wanted to keep you within the DZ zone. They didn't want you drifting out onto the road or wherever it is. So that was, you know, well under control, easily seen through. That's number one. Well, as in everything, you certain things come back in your mind afterwards. And the second jump, for some reason, I don't know, I could only think of all the downside, all the negatives. And I'll admit I was scared stiff. Because I could remember all the, your stomach coming up into your mouth and the sudden drop. And then suddenly you'd be static, seemingly static, as the canopy opened up and you'd be suspended and you would gradually drift down to terra firma. So the second jump was the worst, undoubtedly. The worst of anything, no doubt about that. So I complete, you know, you complete the two statutory, mandatory balloon jumps, and then you move on to aircraft, first aircraft. And again, it's always depending upon the weather, and depending upon just the weather, I suppose. Up at crack of dawn, there are two times of the day when the wind speed, as measured in knots, is at its lowest, and that is at dawn and at dusk. So they would try and cram as many people through a jump at the dawn. So you'd be up at that time of the year, in the hours of darkness. You would be clamber aboard this, you'd have some breakfast if you could take breakfast. You clamber aboard either a Hastings aircraft or a Valletta aircraft. One was a 4-engine, one was a 2-engined. Both noisy, rattly jobs. Take off from RAF Abingdon. I don't know where it went to. Half an hour, perhaps, 20 minutes. Wandering around the skies of Oxfordshire. And then you'd be over the DZ of Weston on the Green again. And initially you would go out in singles, one at a time, then in sticks of, the next jump would be sticks of 3, and then I think sticks of, I think about 8, but by then you'd been trained, ground training, to handle a weapons container, which would either be strapped to your left leg or your right leg, depending on whether you're going out port or starboard. So there would be a night drop with full kit, I mean main chute, reserve chute, weapons container, I think I was on the first, if not the first, amongst the first, first courses at Abingdon to be trained to have a reserve parachute strapped to your chest. Up to that time, the British Army always had the argument that the British method of training, the main chute, was so reliable, we, British Army, didn't need a reserve. But NATO insisted that all paratroopers in NATO had a reserve chute, which was a nice compact little chute here with a red handle on the top. And of course, it had to be drummed into everybody that when you were walking out to the aircraft or wherever you were walking, you didn't bend down, pick it up by the red handle, and so pull out all the parachute. That was a very much a disciplinary bad thing to do. That was drummed into you. Do not catch hold of the red handle unless you are in an emergency up there somewhere. And it happened, of course. You had to catch hold of it by the hooks on either side. And then when you were getting on the aircraft, you hooked it onto your chest because your main chute would be on there. And then you had to go through the paraphernalia of you were allocated either port or starboard exit. And then that decided on which side you would have your weapons container with any of your own personal weapons and paraphernalia in.
How did that make that decision?
Which decision?
How did it relate to which leg you had it on, depending on which side you were coming out of the aircraft?
When you reached the aircraft, you would be port, starboard, and then you fall into too far. So a Hastings, which was the main workhorse of the RAF at that particular time, replaced by the Hercules, as is today, the Hastings was a port and starboard exit for paratroopers. Maximum 15 port, as a stick, 15 paratroopers, 15, there's a 30, maximum of those.
I might have misunderstood you, but I got the impression there was a link between which side of the aircraft you were on and which leg you would attach your kit bag to.
Yes.
So why was that? How did that work?
Well,
was it just as simple as if you were on the port side of the aircraft, your kit would be on your left-hand leg?
Yeah, I can't remember which way round it was, but remember when you're going out for the exit. Now here I'm a little, memory is not as good, but when you're going out from the exit, you go. Does any of my colleagues demonstrate this to you?
They have, but do you want to just describe it for me as you do it?
You go one, two, one, two, one, two.
So you're sort of dragging your back leg.
So you're dragging your back leg, and I think it would be the back leg, the rear leg, where your weapons container, personal container, was attached. And that was attached by a nylon cord to your harness. And one of the first things you had to do once you exit the aircraft and you'd seen your canopy had billowed, as I would call it, not the right technical word, I know. One of the first things you wanted to do is get rid of that container strapped to your leg. In other words, you pulled the pin and it then dropped on the nylon cord, I think about 15 feet below you. So as you were drifting down on the last third of your descent, you would have below you, swinging below you, a weapons container containing your personal effects.
And because my understanding was those containers could be quite heavy.
Could be.
So did you get a reaction to dropping it, to releasing it?
Yeah, it depends on the poor devils who were serving in a mortar unit. They would have to carry parts of a mortar. I think it was a 2.5-inch mortar. And so there would be the base plate, what's it called? Where you fire the mortar through. Mortar bombs. So they'd have to carry some of that. Now, that was heavy. Now, I'm not sure what the maximum maximum weight of a weapons container would be. The content was really dictated by the volume of the objects you had to carry. Now, Muggins here was very lucky in that I was in the intelligence section, and therefore my bits and pieces were obviously my personal equipment, my personal weapon, my 24-hour ration or 48-hour ration, and the rest of it would have been maps and some aerial photographs, all lightweight stuff, but volume stuff. In other words, you're shoveling all this down into this long container, which I suppose on me would have been from the floor up to about here.
To waist height.
It's about my waist height, yes. If you were a little squirt, 5 foot 6 or so, well then, you know, it would be up here somewhere. But really, those poor devils who were in, say, anti-tank or mortar, medium machine gun, signals, where they had equipment, heavy equipment to carry, it may have been dismantled, but they had to carry it and put it down into their personal weapons container, they would have had that additional weight underneath them, often pendulum swinging back and forward, and that would also have accelerated their descent to the ground. I was fortunate, I didn't have that encumbrance. So when in training, I can't even remember what we used to put, it would have been lightweight stuff to ballast out, to give you the idea of what you were, what an actual jump would have been like. So you did a minimum of 8 jumps. I did 11 because the weather prevented some people from doing a jump. So they used to say to you, right, so-and-so, he's still got to make up to his 8. We have some spare seats. Some of you like to volunteer? Well, you know, I used to volunteer to do I did the extra 3 jumps to make up ballast, as you might say, because once you've done your jump at dawn, collected your everything together, got back on the bus took you back to RAF Abingdon, your day was finished. So that was, from lunchtime onwards, I had the rest of the day to myself, so it was worthwhile volunteering for. So, in those autumn days, that's what happened in Oxfordshire. I enjoyed that. It was good. And then, can't remember the dates again. We were all paraded, received our wings from a squadron leader. So we used to go around like this.
With your leading with your arm.
Yeah, ridiculous. And
were you proud of it?
Yeah. Oh, it was an achievement. And I proved those at Strensor what I was going to do, what could be done. And it worked out, it fell right into my lap. Because, as I indicated earlier on, at that time, early winter now, I suppose, 3 para as the lead battalion of the 16th Independent Parachute Brigade were on standby to go somewhere, and that the whole, that particular squad I was on at RAF Abingdon were posted straight to Aldershot 3 para, Corunna Barracks. I'm sure it was Corunna Barracks. And a couple of colleagues were posted to 2 para, simply because they already had siblings in 2 para, but the rest of us straight there. And then what happened then? Well, it's all a bit of a feet really never touched the ground thereafter. All I can remember is that we were arrived in Corunna Barracks, and all bedlam seemed to be going on there. Everybody seems to be racing around doing something, and we were doing nothing or had nothing to do. So we were being what I would call the odds and sods. We were posted into what was known as holding company until they decided where we should go. And all I can remember vaguely now is I was posted to Bravo Company, where the company commander was Major Stevens. And that was my first taste of life in a regular parachute unit.
And what was that like?
Now, I indicated that everything happened in a rush. I think, on what I found out afterwards, under normal circumstances, you're held for a while, perhaps at RAF Abingdon, and then gradually posted out to the three regular battalions, 1, 2 and 3. And your papers go with you. Now, what I do know for certain is, I was, as I said, we were rushed down to Corona Barracks, and my papers didn't go with me. I don't think the paperwork, your military record up to that time, I don't think it went with any of us. And jumping ahead slightly, my paperwork never caught up with Three Para, in this case, until we were out in Cyprus. So here you have a national serviceman being posted to a regular combat unit. At that time, as I expect many people have told you, the British Army was basically a conscript army. But there were two brigades, certainly, where they were predominantly regulars, signed on the dotted line for 5 years, 7 years, or whatever it happens to be. And that was the Guards Brigade and the Independent Parachute Brigade. And you can see the reasoning behind that, because of the training, perhaps the special expertise that those two brigades required went out on combat operations. With the Guards, I suspect it was a bit of the old tradition, whereas with the parachute, it was there is a tradition, but it's a very young regiment. It's the youngest regiment in the British Army, formed in 1941, so there isn't that tradition going back many centuries. So I was posted, as I say, to Three Para, who were in turmoil, preparing to go somewhere. We were put into what is known as holding company, and eventually it got round to me, and Major Stevens, with his company sergeant major behind him, as always, decided I should join 6th Platoon of... Yeah, 6th Platoon. And so I joined other regulars who I didn't know from Adam. And I was really in a situation which, again, was totally, completely alien to me.
So just describe what it was like for me at the beginning.
I suppose, really, I didn't know whether I was coming or going again.
What was so alien?
I was in a regular unit.
But what difference does that make?
Well, in a regular unit, especially with all regular soldiers, they all seemed to know what they were doing. I'm not saying they actually did, but they seemed to know what they were doing, where they were going, what they had to do. Muggins and the others in holding company, we were spare watsits. We didn't know what was happening. So I suppose we were given, as I remember, general duties to keep us out of mischief. But we were confined to barracks. We were confined, so we had to, stay where we were, and really keep our heads down and keep out of the way. There was a sergeant, as I remembered, who used to come and visit us now every now and again to see we hadn't absconded, I suppose. But other than that, he or everybody else was too busy to be bothered with, these raw, as far as they were concerned, raw recruits.
Was there any issue about the fact that you were a conscript in a outfit that mostly wasn't?
What made you ask that question? Is it something that's been said in the past?
No.
There was, yes. I've tried to find this out since. As I understand it, and I've written to Airborne Forces Depot, and they couldn't give me any precise figures, but my understanding is that the parachute regiment, which, as you know now, is all regular, in fact, it's all regular, the parachute at that regiment at that time only contained about 5 to 2% of national servicemen. They didn't want them, which I can fully understand, because they maintained by the time they'd trained you, you'd posted and you'd gained experience, real experience, in a combat unit, you're almost ready to come out and finish, and go back to Civvy Street. And to them, that was a waste of time, waste of money, so they didn't really want you. But for reasons which I don't understand, they took this 5%, 2%, so I belong to that, very much that minority. Now, I believe, and I've no actual proof of this, but I believe that if it had been a normal situation and my papers had gone with me, I wouldn't have been posted to a combat unit of either 1, 2 or 3 para. I would have been hidden away in a TA regiment or some other place where I couldn't do anybody any harm, as they would see it. So I was eventually posted into Bravo Company, and then, I don't know, everything is very much a muddle, but eventually we were told we were on 48 or 72, then 48, then 24-hour notice. And now the only thing that sticks out in my memory is everything that was movable had either been tucked away somewhere where it couldn't be stolen, or it was wrapped up in under tarpauling, under trailers or other such places to be flown out to wherever we were going. And eventually, as I expect some of my colleagues have told you, we were told we were going to Cyprus, and we would be flown out in an almighty hurry from Blackbush. As usual, times haven't changed, they're still the same today. RAF, poor old RAF Transport Command, didn't have sufficient Hastings and Valettas to take us out in a reasonably civilised air transport fleet. So I think I would have been in the back end of going out to Cyprus. So what they did, they allocated Coastal Command Shackletons. Now, the Coastal Command Shackleton was the workhorse anti-submarine four-engined aircraft, a redesigned Halifax from World War II. And we were bussed out to Blackbush Airport in the early hours of one morning.
This would be November 55.
Yeah, I suppose so. Our personal kit was shoved in the bomb bays, and we had in cardboard cartons, as I remember it, rations in there to last us from taking off from Blackbush, a stop in Lucca Airport, Malta, and then on to Nicosia Airport and Cyprus. All I remember of that plane was that there wasn't sufficient seating for everybody. There was ample room. I don't know how many were on that aircraft. But we used to wander around, try to sleep. We were flying through the night. And the RAF Shackleton, being a Coastal Command aircraft, had what they call an astrodome halfway along the fuselage between where the flight crew would be and the tailplane would be. And in the astrodome you could pop your head up and view 360 degrees. And it was my luck that that particular Shackleton was flying south-east over the Pyrenees, because you could look down out to this astrodome. We used to take it in turns to go up into the astrodome, and you could look down, you could see the snow-capped Pyrenees. You could look back northwest and see the blackness of the Bay of Biscay, and the curve of the bay and the lights there. I don't know what cities they would be. Maybe Bordeaux, I don't know. Toulon. No, not Toulon, Toulouse. And then you could look due southeast. This was the remarkable thing. You could look southeast and you could just see the sun breaking and the sun reflecting off the Mediterranean. So I had a view, a unique view. Pyrenees below, Mediterranean with the sun coming up and the sun not having reached the Bay of Biscay yet, inky blackness behind. Marvellous. And then we landed in Lucca Airport. There we had to stay because of what was reported to be engine trouble. So we had, I think, about 12 hours to kill time in Malta. And of course, we were allowed off the camp. It all seemed very, from, you know, training days, all very alakifik, as the phrase I often used. So we went down into Valletta and had a nosy around there. And then made sure we were... Valletta at that time seemed to be occupied by the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy... Where's the Royal Navy? There always seemed to be police. And we were, I think, on balls, as far as they were concerned. These fellows wandering around with maroon berries. And then we went back to RAF Lucca by taxi. And planed. And then onward to RAF Nicosia.
And what are your memories of that? What's your first memories of Cyprus?
Heat. Warmth. Lovely. Stepped out of the plane. And then we were bused to a camp under canvas. As I remember it, it was within the Nicosia airport boundary, surrounded by barbed wire, the tents, four-man tents, were on duckboards, and then outside the tents there would be additional duckboards for you to use as walkways should the rains come, which they did. So, you know, we were all allocated four to a tent. Canvas beds, kerosene lamps, highly dangerous. All your personal kit for four people in one of these tents, with fly sheets. I've been okay. I've been camping before, been a Boy Scout before, but I've never seen or experienced this sort of thing. So you've got these people thrown together. It was acceptable while the weather was dry. And then I suppose it must have been January, certainly February, the wet season arrived. And to me, it rained and it rained and it rained. And there were gullies of water and you had to keep as far as possible to the duckboards. But you never, as I remember it, never really kept yourself dry as we do in this environment, although fortunately the weather was very mild. It wasn't, you know, a winter as we experience in this country, so it was wet and mild. Dangers. Kerosene lamps. Each tent had a kerosene lamp to start off with, which you put paraffin. You drew off the paraffin from the QM stores. That was a dangerous trip in itself. So you had, you know, 700, I don't know what the actual headcount would have been in those days, all living in these bivouacs, tented camp. And then we were allowed to go into the RAF quarters to wash and shower, clean ourselves up. But I suppose in reality it was a bit of a nightmare. But we were still an operational unit as far as I could observe, bearing in mind I'm a green boy, naive. It was during this time that Each of us in holding company were called up before the 2IC, a major in rank, and he didn't have my papers then. I had to briefly give an abbreviated indication of my background, civilian background, where I'd come from, and he decided therefore to allocate this green youth, young man, to headquarters company intelligence section.